The new year means different things to each of us, but one thing that all of us can relate to is filing our taxes. That's why for the past 15 years, I've gone to my guy Rob at ARS & Associates for all of my personal and professional accounting needs, especially during tax season. Rob is professional, he's trustworthy, and if there's something that should be on my tax return, he makes sure it's there and does not get overlooked. In addition to personal accounting, the team at ARS handles corporate work, bookkeeping, payroll, and more. So call ARS & Associates now for a free consultation at 305-653-7350 or visit their website at arsaccounting.com. That's arsaccounting.com. And make sure you mention that the Fish Tank sent you to get 20% off the cost of preparing your tax return. Start saving now.
You're now diving into the Fish Tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, Trap, OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, golf fans, number one. Of course, y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk. Dive up in that fish tank.
Welcome back to the Fish Tank. Seth Levitt here with OJ McDuffie. Juice, we have just kind of an unexpected treat here today.
What a trio we have right here, Big Seth. I mean, you got to think about this, man. How often do you get three legends from the Miami Dolphins in the building at the same time recording a podcast with your boys?
It doesn't happen, and I don't know who booked it, but I'll give you the credit. So, you know, we knew Larry Little was coming in. Larry had committed, and we were talking to Larry Ball, and I turn around and, oh, shit, there's Zonka and there's Merck. We might have all three guys. So, gentlemen, welcome to the Fish Tank. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it,
man.
Good to be here. Great being here.
So, guys, I know it's a big weekend for you guys coming in, celebrating the most amazing football team, obviously, in NFL history, the 72 team. How's it been so far with you guys getting back and, for real, shooting the shit with each other like old times?
Well, we do this about every 5 years, man. So, for our own inner circle, collectively, this is something that we kind of look forward to. Getting together every 5 years and really kind of reminiscing and doing things that keeping up and seeing who else is getting older and older and older and older and older. But we're still here.
Thank God you guys are still here, and we love celebrating it. So we were just talking to Larry Ball, and we had Sipe on before and Kick, and, you know, Larry was talking about, and he said, I hate to quote Merck. He said, but, you know, somebody maybe somebody will figure it out and go undefeated, but they'll just have accomplished something. They won't have done what you guys did. You guys did something that has yet to be duplicated, and from your perspective, it doesn't matter what they do, they can't truly duplicate what you guys accomplished.
No doubt, because we were the first to do it, and we've been on top of this mountain by ourselves for a long time. So if someone want to come up, they can join us, but they cannot surpass
That's right. Let's go back in time a little bit. Let's talk, Zonk. You know, you're an Ohio cat like myself. You grew up, I believe, in Stowe, Ohio.
I tried to.
grow up. And we always talk about guys like us that come from the Midwest and ended up playing down in South Florida. How was that transition from being an Ohioan and then coming down and playing down here in South Florida?
Hot.
Yeah. That was a big thing.
Real hot. Yeah. I thought I knew the definition of hot, but I knew the definition of warm.
Right.
I thought I knew the definition of cold growing up in Northeast Ohio, but I found out when I played ball at Syracuse that there was a new definition of cold, particularly hitchhiking on Interstate 90 past Buffalo. So my world was an expanding world at the ripe old age of 20 years.
Yeah, it was a snow belt up there, right, in Syracuse? Yeah, a lot of snow up there.
And there was a sun belt down here. And the sun belt wasn't too bad because our head coach then was named George Wilson, and he was at the end of his career. He had a very illustrious career, but he'd come down and formed the expansion team and coached the expansion team down here, and they had a pretty relaxed attitude about it. I mean, think about it. You got brand new team coming into a league, not much expected. So George, quite frankly, lived up to that part. He just said, you know, if it's too hot, we'll take a deal. We'll go by the, you guys remember,
oh yeah,
George would line us all up and say it's 94 degrees. Take your shoulder pads off and
go
throw them
jump
at your
in the
feet,
pool.
That's right.
Shoes
That's
off,
right.
And march us to the pool, and we'd all have a pool party. Then we met this guy named Shula. He had a different perspective of all that. We were getting quite used to the pool routine. We're kind of enjoying it. And then he came down, and the proverbial crap hit the fan, and things went just as far the other direction, which a lot of us, me included, objected to and bucked the system, quite frankly. But then we started to win. And when we started to win, the bitching started settling down because When you start to win, it's a special kind of elixir. You know what I'm talking about. I see it in your eyes. You know exactly what I'm talking about. When you start to win, you start to feed on that, and then the camaraderie, you start to think about what else can we win? How else can we beat these guys? And we started really getting into it. Now, that's not to suggest that we still didn't bitch about Chula. We did, because he was way over the top. You know, he was overkill. He told us, and if I'm lying, you guys jump in here and straighten me out. He told us, we have two ways of looking at this heat thing down here. We can either use it as a negative and hide from it, like everybody else does, or we can use it to our advantage and make it a liability, an asset. So if we learn how to practice for 2.5 hours without any water in 94-degree heat, then we can become camel-like during the game. And when people come down here from other places, we'll see in the fourth quarter who has their heads up and who's down. And that literally came to pass. And like I said, correct me
you're
if
right,
I'm wrong.
You're correct.
But when he said that, who was buying in?
We all bought in.
Chicken passed
in.
Out.
Yeah, I faked
but
the pass
not
out.
Really.
I faked the pass out on him.
You were I captain said, of the team, and we're all counting on him to bail us
I
out.
I told my roommate the night before I passed out, I'm not going to let the son of a bitch kill me.
but Larry, you're from this area, so
I'm
you should have been
Miami.
Used to this shit. You should have been used to the heat, the atmosphere, the you know the humidity. You should have been used to it going to Booker T.
He was at San Diego and came here. San Diego's a pretty relaxed place to be, and then he came here, was under George Wilson for a year. So we were both relaxed and ready.
You know,
all of a sudden, this guy from Mars comes in here and starts killing us.
The night before, I literally passed out, as they say.
I say you did.
I told my roommate, like I said earlier, I'm not going to let the son of a bitch kill me. So I timed it. And around an hour and a half into practice, I started reeling a little, reeling. And all of a sudden, I hit the ground. Lundy and the other trainers ran over to me. And they put me in the big old, remember that old station wagon we had out there?
that like the ambulance? Is that like the transport?
They put me in that big red Chevrolet, took me into the locker room, started packing me in ice. And I said, oh, shit. I got to think of plan B now.
That's not the route you wanted to go, is it?
Well, I jumped up like I was
You're too good of an actor, apparently.
I started having hallucinations then. And I missed. See, we were going 4 times a day, too, now.
They still thought you were suffering from heat stroke, but it was really the ice that was giving you hallucinations.
4 times a day in practice. That's
4 days.
Four practices a day. All wearing pads, but just mentally. You know, being out there on that field. So they sent me to this doctor. They couldn't find anything wrong. They sent me to another doctor. They couldn't find anything wrong. So they finally sent me to an internist. The doctor said, Larry, I've been through you all up and above. I don't see a damn thing wrong with you. I said, well, doc, you've got to find something. He said, well, you do have a slight sinus problem. I said, well, put that on there. Well, that's a true story.
Oh my goodness!
Oh, he was our captain, and he was trying something to save us from one of us really dying. He sacrificed himself a little bit, but nobody's going to trade him at that point.
Right,
you know,
right,
rock solid. But you know, then later into the season, when we had some, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, we had some plus 85 degree days in like October, and you have a team like the 49ers or someone like that come in here, and they're not used to that above 85, and we weaned on it. So we're in the fourth quarter, you look over there, you know, the offensive unit stand out on the field, and we're looking over there, and you can see there are two defensive tackles down on a knee and one defensive end.
Well, tobacco coming out of his mouth, slobbing out of his mouth.
Where are you gonna go with the ball? You're going to go right at those guys that are hanging their heads, right?
Right.
And it became the asset that Chula talked about. He was right, and it was a good thing because none of us died in the end.
Yeah, and Merck, you growing up in Pittsburgh, I mean, you had to realize the difference too, you know, being a kid from the Western Pennsylvania area, coming down here and dealing with the heat. I mean, you bought in at one point as well, right?
Well, first of all, I'm from Pittsburgh, but I went to school in Texas.
Right, West Texas.
In the High Plains of Texas. So we didn't experience too much cold down. It got cold, but not, and no snow or anything like that. So when I came down here, I mean, it was ridiculously hot. I had a different perspective because I got hurt the first night of practice. I got a knee in the thigh by a guy named Dale McCullers in Shula's first year because the strike, well, there was a two-week strike when during the merger of the AFC and the NFC, which it became from the NFL in the NFL. And that merger produced a two-week strike, and then the end of the strike, it was in the evening, and he made us practice that evening, and it was dark. And we were literally out there in the dark with no lights, and McCullers hits me in the knee and nails me, and I go in the meeting, and next thing I know, my thigh is tightening up, and next thing I know, I start sweating, and then tears start coming out of my eyes, and Dr. Virgin, whom I'm sure was the model from...
look at the reaction from the other guys
this
here.
This guy, Virgin, man, the island of Dr. Moreau. And this guy, he looks at me, he goes, oh, you'll be all right in a day and a half. So the next morning I was in surgery, and I was out for 4 months, 3.5 months, and I watched these guys go through all of that. And keep in mind, Shula came with the idea and let people know that nobody's going to make this team. That if you've made it already, you're going to make it out of what you do now. So everybody was trying to make the team at that time. But the practices were so that I watched these guys go out, and they were so hard and long and monotonous and fast. People hated to go to sleep at night because they knew when they woke up that they were going to go right back over to that field. It wasn't like it is now where these guys go home. I mean, we were there for 6 weeks. And it was like a regiment boot camp that they were there. And these to this day, these guys says, man, you guys, man, remember those 4 days we went through? I said, fortunately, no, I don't, because I was in surgery and I was hurt the whole time.
We'll be back in a day and a half, right? Dr. Virgin
Four
said.
Months it took me.
That's wild.
Yeah.
That's wild. So you were talking about how difficult the practices were in the heat, and I love that Zonk said Coach Shula was like a man from Mars here compared to what you guys were used to. But we had another buddy of yours in the tank here recently, Jim Kick, and Jim could not stop talking about the 12-minute run. And I know you guys were talking about it a little bit before you jumped on the show here. So where does the 12-minute run fit in all of this part of the conversation here?
For me, it was just a matter of trying to make it. Dick Anderson was the guy who was – he would be the premier guy that would run that 12-minute run. He would always come in first, and Larry would always try to pass out the way through it. And, I mean, he did it like clockwork. It wasn't like, you know, it was a happenstance thing. He did it like clockwork every year. And then he would go out, and they try to make it – because you don't just get – well, you didn't make it. You had to go out and run it the next day.
It was the plan right. behind yes. what I did.
So right. then he had Junior, this other guy who was a combination half a equipment man and had worked with, partly with Bob Lundy. He'd go have Junior go out there with him, and Larry would go out there and intimidate Junior.
All right, now, Junior, now, I ain't going to run but three laps, but you're going to tell him that I
never said I ain't, and I said I'm not.
Oh, you know what? Shit. You have the nerve to correct me.
Oh, yeah, don't say I ain't. Never, I don't use ain't.
Hold it. Okay. Don't make me tell that story about
you.
Don't let
me tell shit.
See, you know.
Please tell it, Mark.
Okay. Now, we're out at the casino out there with the and Miccosukee. And Chicken was working with me, and we had this Johnny Carson, Ed McMahon thing going. And so we would go up, and during a halftime, I mean, during the commercials, we'd give stuff away. And so one day, I told him, I said, okay, Chicken, never mind. You stay back. I'll go up. So we had two mics up there. So I said, okay, I'm going to read the numbers. And then I stepped to the next mic and I said,
no, I'm going to read the numbers.
and then I stepped back to the next mic and says, no, man, I said, I'm going to read the numbers. And I said,
he said, hey, what's wrong with you? I said, I'm going to read the numbers.
I said, okay, read the numbers.
All right, 270-46, who got it?
I says, nope, you got it. Okay, all right, here it is. I get back to the table. He goes, hey, son of a bitch. I don't never say with you. I say with you. You start that man Dan Mullen shit in front of these white folks, and I'm going to kick your ass. And I go, Larry, you should hear yourself. Now, tell me that didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
You're the liar stink.
And you know, and that's an interesting point right there, because you guys came down here in an interesting time in history. You talk about the early 70s, and you know, South Florida wasn't the easiest place for men of color, I'm sure. You know, so I'm not sure of any situations you guys had to run into down here. I know what my mom went through in Ohio at that point, But it had to be an interesting situation for you guys down here.
Let me field this. When, because this is Anka's involved in this.
Uh-oh.
Now, previously in the locker rooms, they had Brill Cream, Wild Root, and Vitalis as what you would put on your hair.
Right.
As hair stuff. So in the 1970s, Zonk tells me that he's walking back from lunch with Shula, and he says, Shula says, Zonk says, hey, listen, how did the black ball players feel? I got some Afro Sheen and some Afro Picks, some Afro Combs. And how do they feel? And Zonk says, how do I know? I'm a honky just like you. You have to go ask Merck or somebody like that. Huh? But Don put forth the effort.
Yeah.
Because we had segregated rooming with George Wilson. And the first thing Shula did when he got here is put Paul Warfield with Bob Greasy to signal that those days were over.
Nice.
And had me with Cooch.
You and Cooch?
But for the bad I did.
Why is that, Larry?
Cooch snored like hell. And I smoked. He can stand smoke and I can stand snoring.
That's a hell of a combination.
They broke that shit up in a hurry.
Okay. Yeah, how long did that last?
About a week. About a week.
And who'd you room with, Zonk? Who were you with?
Kick.
You and Kick?
I was, yeah, room with Jimmy the whole time. And when I came back in 79, the last year I played, I came back and I think I roomed with Cooch.
Yeah.
That year.
I thought it was Delvin.
Oh, I ended up with Delvin. Well, I started with Delvin.
Okay.
And then Delvin left, disappeared. And I ended up with Cooch, I think, because whoever Kuchenberg's roommate was got hurt.
Langer was Kuchenberg. He had gone.
So I ended up with Cooch.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's a real treat when you room with Cooch.
There. Exactly how many times did you and Kick sneak out back in the early days there?
Merck, you would stand better advised to ask us how many times we stayed.
A little easier to keep track of.
Funniest stories in the world. When we first got to camp, everybody was so scared of Shula because he, cut you over anything. You know, right. You hiccup, a fart in a meeting, you're gone.
Yep.
And some of us, when you think about being gone, what did that really? Everybody wanted to stay because you feared maybe not, having to go back and actually start working a 9-to-5 job somewhere and getting out of sports. But looking at it now, you realize, we might have had a little more clout than what we realized we had. But Kick and I just, funniest story is when we'd go out, go over the hedge and through the bushes and out, park our cars on the other side, disappear. One night we came back and we're both sneaking back and Kick got lost in the bushes. And I go back to find him. We both scared each other and run the wrong way. Run right into a security guard. We had to get the security guard. And we started out trying to threaten him, and that didn't work. The security guard didn't care. And so we ended up having to bribe him. So that's what happened to camp.
So now Jim stated when he was on the show that he got blamed for all of it. Now, you guys might have been running together, but he said, no, Zonk never got in trouble, that he got blamed for everything. How much of that is revisionist history, or is he telling the truth there?
No, he's telling the truth.
So why was that? Why did Jim?
Because I could anticipate what Shula was going to do. We're both hunkies. We both grew up in Ohio. I had a lot in common with Don. And I knew, he was strict Catholic upbringing, and I was not such a strict Catholic upbringing, but Catholic upbringing. And because of that, I could have a little extra sensory awareness of when he was fixing to blow off, Shula was going to fix it. And I would avoid the situation. When we put the alligator in his shower, when he came in, saw that come screaming out of the deal and running into the locker room, I heard him coming. I knew what he was going to do. So I shot into the shower room, and he runs out to the locker where me and Kick usually are because he assumes it was us, and which we was half right. And he starts screaming at Kick. So Kick did get – he caught the brunt of the thing, just like in the 12-minute run or, the Olympic you can play football if you can run 17 miles deal, When he caught up to Kick, I stopped to walk with Kick because it was a 12-minute run, get as far as you can, was the way it was represented the day before.
We started that.
In other words – run as far as you can. If you got to walk, you got to walk. But we're going to measure how far you get. If you don't get at least a mile or mile and a half, whatever it was, then you have to repeat it. Well, I'm sitting there. I hear walk as far, run as far as you can. So I did. I ran a couple laps around there. And, Kix has asthma real bad that time of year. So he stops and starts walking because he literally can't breathe. He's turning blue. So I come running up beside him about the third lap, figure if he's walking, what the hell? I'll just walk with him. So I stop and start walking with him. About that time, Shula's on the other side of the field and sees us stop to walk together. And in Shula's words, what are the odds on two guys getting exactly the same amount of tired at the same time? So he comes running across, and I'm on the outside walking, looking past Jim as we're walking, and I can see Shula running all red-faced towards us. So I just start jogging again. So he can't catch up to me.
And Jim can't.
Up to kick. That was always the way.
He's trying to breathe.
He's walking behind kick like Hitler. You know, he's throwing his hands up, and, you know, it's wild.
It would be no more walk, run. It would be all run. That's when I got mine in. Now, I knew, talking about 12-minute run, they knew I wasn't going to make it. Shula knew I wasn't going to make it when we ran it. And that's when I got Junior the next morning and said, Junior, I'm going to run two laps, not three laps. Two laps. And then you're going to tell the old man I ran the whole distance. I knew Shula knew I wasn't making it because he could look from his office to the field. He knows how many times he'll go. But what the hell could he think? As long as he felt power that we had to run it the next morning. If he could care less if I made it or not the next day, because he knew what I was going to do on Sunday. Okay.
Yeah, so I remember like the running, those the 12-minute run is like you passed it and then there are like blue marks, right? It was like the exceptional. Like they had the blue marks back then too where you had to pass it. I knew because when I got there, you know, you passed it. Then he tried to show other guys up like, oh, he not only did he pass it, he got to a blue mark, which is like an extra lap or whatever it might have been. You know, that created a little problem, I think, at times with us where guys trying to show other guys up, man. Do your job. Do what you're supposed to do and start the walk with Larry and Jim.
I could have cared less.
Hey, let's talk about a little bit, man. Of course, we talk about the 72 team a lot, going perfect. Let's go back a couple years. I think 69 for you guys. I believe 68 for you, Larry. Zonk. So I think – so you think about those years – how was it then before you guys got to the Super Bowl you lost and then the two that you won after that? It wasn't as good a team, obviously, as the teams that went perfect.
Well, first of all, you're talking about two different worlds here.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the merger came, that's when things changed. But prior to that, it was the old school. And Wilson was old school. And he did not subscribe to winning. Well, a typical speech before a game – well, if we get a few breaks, as he's smoking on a cigarette, and a ball bounces our way, we might come out on top. Now go get them. And then you had guys out there, Maxie Williams and Billy Neighbors and all these guys who they'd put in their cigarettes out at the door so to save them before they came in at halftime. And that was my rookie year in 69. So I'm going, wait a minute, this is pro football right here?
Right.
This is it? I mean, we had a guy named Les Bingman, who was a coach at that time, and he literally died on the sideline.
Pre-season
and Virgin
pre-season game, yeah.
Pulled out his needles and stuck a thing in his heart and literally brought him back to life. But this is when we were on the side. You know, you talk about the calculation of Don Shula. I only this year saw, and I don't know where it came from, I saw the aspect of the technology that Shula used in order to utilize the fact that when first thing he did when he came was switch us, which we were in the sun on the side where the sun is, and moved us to the side on the shade where the shade was. And then he moved those guys, the visiting team, over so they'd be in the hot sun the whole time. But then he started calculating when would be the hottest part of the day. And when I saw this calculation that he did not long ago, I saw it from back then. I mean, it was this intricate concept of how hot it was going to be during the specific times of the games. And he would do that in relationship to the kind of plays that he would run, the kind of things that we would try to get down. I mean, it was a kind of like a science that he put it to that but that's the first thing he did was switch us over so that these guys would be in the heat. Now you couple that with that polyturf, and that stuff was like 120 degrees down there, you know that, and to see the science of what he would try to do, and you'd go in the first half, you see a quarterback kneeling, and there was an 18-inch crown in the Orange Bowl, so you literally couldn't see if a guy was kneeling down, you didn't see his lower half of his body, so you'd see the quarterback kneeling down in the second half with a towel over his head, you knew they were toast. And that was one of the things that Don was always trying to get on this ring. It says the winning edge. and that kind of stuff was part of it.
Sounds like that calculation that at that about that same time Larry was calculating the pass out. So yeah. there was a counter calculation. I love it. So also in those early years, I'd love to talk about, you know, each of you had a different path getting to this franchise, and Larry being a first round draft choice, and Murky also drafted to the team, So Zonk, we'll say Zonk, and then Larry Little, you weren't drafted, right? Free agent, ended up in San Diego. I read somewhere you had a $750 signing bonus. They took good care of you to get you out there. And actually, then you get traded here.
Actually, my rookie year, I may have made $8,000 because my contract was $12,500. My bonus was $750. Before I got to camp, I was broke. After the takeout, I wasn't active the first four games. So you calculate that less. After state and federal tax, I may have made.
Did you owe them money at the end, Larry?
But, you know, after I was traded back home here to Miami for, ironically, my high school teammate. His name was Mac Lamb. And I would come home every year during the off season, and we had a certain watering hole where we hung out at during the off season that called a satellite, where the Dolphin players would hang out, and I would come home and I would hang out there with them. And I get news that I've been traded to. I just sent my plane ticket back to fly back out to San Diego. I just gotten the word that I was coming to Miami. I've been traded to Miami. And Mac walked into the watering hole. And I said, Mac, I just been traded back to Miami. And Mac said, oh, man, he hadn't gotten the word yet. He said, oh, man, we'll be teammates again.
Huh? Oh, he's getting all excited.
I said, no, Mac. You were traded for me.
What was the look on his face at that point?
Oh, man, he was shocked. But Mac did not make the team in San Diego. And Sid Gilman, my coach in San Diego, called it a nothing-for-nothing deal. And that was during my time home when I first met Zonk at Eaton and Buick. And we met each other, and he was still with the Dolphins. I was still with the Chargers. He was with the Dolphins. We started talking. About 2 months later, I guess, Zonk, I was traded. You can tell you the rest of that story.
12 days later, I left. I went to Eaton Buick because I had a car that had been damaged and I had to have it repaired. I had had two or three concussions my rookie year at the Dolphins, and sometimes getting the handoff and getting a defensive player at the same time was, getting to be pretty much the usual. And the third concussion, I decided, we're going to. So I'm on my way down to Eaton Buick. It's like towards the end of the season, or after the 68 season. And I go over to open the door in Eaton Buick, and I'm walking in. And as I open the door, I meet this giant of a fellow walking out. And I said, what's your name? And he said, Larry Little. I said, who do you play for? And he said, San Diego. And I said, why are you here? He said, I live here. He said, why are you here? And then we started talking, and we chatted for a while. I left that meeting and went straight down to Biscayne Boulevard, where the front office was, and went up the elevator to the 7th floor and met with Joe Thomas, the personnel man. And I just told him, I walked in, I said, does the name Larry Little mean anything to you? He said, yeah, he plays for San Diego. We're going to trade him. We're going to try to trade him. I said, you got to get him. He said, why are you so interested in that? I said, for Christ's sake, I can hide behind him. He said, well, you don't know how good a blocker. I said, I don't care how good a blocker he is. Look at my head. I can hide. He said, we're so many dollars off. I said, take it off mine, put it on his. I don't care. He said, you do that? I said, we're talking survival, Joe. We're not talking about winning record here. We're talking about survival, So that he said, well, how emphatic are you? I said, oh, I'll tell you what, Joe, we're on the 7th floor. If you've got wings, you got no fear. I said, if he doesn't come to us and I'm getting hit like that next year, you better learn to fly, son, because you're going out that window, He said, you go there. I said, absolutely. I said, you don't have to be necessarily a great long-term football coach or talent scout. If you're a running back, and Merck knows what I'm talking about, there's people you meet and you shake hands with them and you're talking to them, you think, now, the speed things will be judged on the field, but you get the drift of where they're coming from. And, it's a feeling you get. And when I stepped in there and saw him, I thought, this has got to be one of my offensive linemen. So I went down and put my 2 cents in. They did not take anything from mine and put it on his. I didn't have nothing to do with it other than telling Joe Thomas I might kill it.
Seventh floor.
If he didn't get him, he damn sure better get somebody, because things were bad.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting from a nothing-for-nothing trade, you know, and Sid, did Sid call you? Where'd you get chicken from? Chicken Little.
Oh, well, let me tell you this story. When I was with the Chargers, we were training in a town called Escondido, California. And Escondido, it was hot like Miami. But anyway, only thing we were eating down there was Mexican food. My first night in San Diego, the city of San Diego, they had a fried chicken place called Brady Keys Fried Chicken. Brady Keys was from California, but he played with the Steelers. I ate a whole chicken that night. Fried chicken. And drank a fifth of Ripple wine. That name hit me in San Diego, and it followed me all the way to Miami. I have never been able to shake Chicken Little.
Yeah, but it wasn't because of that one box. It was because of the 1 million boxes that he consumed. I was out in California. We were doing something. We ended up in Las Vegas, and it was kind of cool. And I'm walking in, and I see somebody trying to get in the side door of the hotel, of the Sands Hotel, back when they had those ones. And I see somebody trying to get in the side of the door. I go, what are you doing? He's dressed up in a jean jacket suit, you know, pants and jacket,
70.
With a big bucket of chicken up underneath his arm, you know. And I go, what are you doing with that chicken? He said, I'm trying to get in the door. I'm trying to get in. Oh, you're trying to sneak in the side door so you don't have to walk through the lobby with that bucket of chicken. Man, just go on around there and open the door for me. So I went around and opened the door. And it's not like that's the incident. Everywhere I've gone with this guy, not long ago, it may have been last year, we went up to Washington and we did something, and we were there the night before. So he orders like 48 wings, all right? So he only eats 24 of them.
Another goddamn lie.
Hey, and so then he takes the wings and he puts them away. So we're coming back the next day.
Put them away. Right?
And I go, what's that I smell? He says, oh, that's my chicken wings. I said, what are you doing with it? I got them on a plane. Wait a minute, the ones from last night? He says, yeah, I'm taking them home.
Can't waste these good wings now, Larry.
Now, tell the truth.
Tell him another goddamn lie.
This man won't admit to the truth.
I love it.
How many did you eat, Mert?
How many did I eat?
Yeah.
Zero.
You did.
Not one.
Some story about
that. I was a health nut.
Do you know? He goes to the bathroom 12 times a day.
You know,
guys, 12 we might be getting
times.
Can we get back to the championship?
It's a different kind of championship, though.
I just rode down here with him in the elevator. I don't even start.
That's my point.
I said, man, let's get to the elevator. I got to go to the room, man.
Hey, Juice, the only thing better than looking clean is looking clean on your own time.
No doubt about it, Big Seth. And that's why I always call my man Ara at A&T Dry Cleaners anytime I need my clothes laundered or dry cleaned.
Tell him exactly why you call Ara.
Because A&T offers free pickup and delivery at your home or office, so you never have the inconvenience of trying to find time to take your dry cleaning somewhere. They bring it to you.
That's exactly right, Juice. You can walk into their Fort Lauderdale location, but A&T serves Miami-Dade, Broward, and the Southern Palm Beaches with their convenient pickup and delivery services, which also include alterations, shoe repair, and more.
And A&T is a family-owned company, and they've been in business since 1980.
1980?
Yeah, and you know what? That means customer service is their priority.
So call Ara today at 954-610-9383. That's his personal cell we're giving you. Or you can visit drycleanertoyou.com to start making your life and your dry cleaning a lot easier.
And make sure you tell them that the Fish Tank sent you, because Ara, my man, is giving our listeners 50% off your first order.
How much?
50. Half, Seth. Wow. Half. And 25% off any dry cleaning services after that.
A&T Dry Cleaning, the official dry cleaners of the Fish Tank.
All right, we'll try and dial it back a little bit here. So Zonk just told the story of the first time he met Larry, and you were willing to give a little bit of your paycheck to get Larry over here. So 4 or 5 years later, you and Jim and Paul Warfield leave for the World Football League. And I don't know if one had to do, you know, revisionist history when I read these articles, but Larry all of a sudden becomes the first $100,000 a year guard in NFL history. So maybe they did give a little bit of yours to his just a few years later.
They didn't give anything to him. He earned everything he ever got.
He helped my, but what he helped what my contract, no doubt. Was,
yep.
When we signed at this meeting with Mr. Well, that's a long story, but we signed with the World Football League. But I knew at that moment that was going to go national you know, the next day, and for the most impact. So I, you know, I called a lot of my teammates and said, what's going to happen here is, you know, there's going to be dominoes falling.
Sure.
The reality of the dollar per player relationship or ratio in the world of professional football had just changed. And to understand that, even if you were signed in a contract for another year or two, every one of the NFL players, particularly the named players, had been selected by different World Football League teams. Mm. And that gave you bargaining power for, even if you weren't on the last year of your contract, for future years could be signed for at that time. In other words, even if you were still locked into the particular team you were with for a year or two, you could sign that third, fourth, and fifth year
with the other league.
With the other league, and your intent was to step out of this league and step to the other. There's nothing wrong with that. But for them to know that, you know, I knew that because we had just signed, and that the size of that contract was going to blow up in the press in the next couple of days. So I called my offensive lineman and defensive players. I called everybody I could get a hold of on the team and told them, here's what's coming. You need to know this, and you need to find out who your rights are with in the World Football League.
Wow.
And I'll help you do that if you need to. But this door is going to open, and it's going to stay open as long as that World Football League is there, but you don't know how long it's going to be there. So you need to capitalize, because teams like, well, this, all the teams in the NFL, we're going to have to start signing their players to longer-term contracts to protect the rights so they don't step away. So whoever takes advantage of that first gets it. So I called my teammates and told them.
When you hung up the phone with him, Larry, what was your next phone call?
No, he called me. I said, take me with you. Exactly what I said, take me with you.
I would have if I could have.
But you know what, though? Out of that, Joe Robbie did, and Joe Robbie was tight. Everybody knows Joe
Robbie. Well documented.
Was tight. Joe Robbie renegotiated, because Zonk and Kick and I believe it was that we came off of, we all three of us came off of a 3-year, $150,000, $155,000, I can't remember what it was, but we were averaging about $52,000, $53,000 a year. And then these guys went to the World Football League in 1974. We only signed that contract in 1973. And Joe Robbie, who would never renegotiate anybody's contracts, he renegotiated two contracts, Larry Little's contract and my contract. And I went from – Larry
Smart
became
man.
The first $100,000 lineman in league's history. And I went from 3 years, $155,000, to 5 years, $675,000. And I became the second highest player on the team. Greasy was making $190,000 at that particular time. And then when I got traded to San Diego, I was the highest paid player on the team at $135,000. And Dan Fouts was there.
Oh, wow.
And I remember Tommy Prothrow talking about how I wasn't really worth the $135,000. You know, and so when I looked at his contract and looked at his play, I said, you have to consider whether or not you were worth whatever it is you were getting.
right. You know, worry about your own deal there,
buddy.
Next time
season will be the first. But Zonk did that move that Paul and Jim and Larry made. That did change the dynamic as far as Miami was concerned. As Larry, I can't speak for any other teams, but for Larry and I, it changed that, because Joe Robbie would never – even consider reading it. But then he said, Mercury, as long as you're in Miami, you'll always have a job. Then 2 years later, I'm in San Diego.
I love talking about Miami and, you know, you guys down here and the advantage you guys had, you know, in the Orange Bowl. First of all, you touched on a little bit that heat in the Orange Bowl, the atmosphere in the Orange Bowl, the fans in the Orange Bowl. I played there in college, and I didn't get a chance to play there as a Miami Dolphin, but just talk about that whole atmosphere in general. I mean, I know you guys are already used to the heat because you've been down here and you use it to your advantage. But talk about that atmosphere, how loud that place was, and, you know, how other teams just come and melt, you know, to not just the heat, but to the atmosphere and the surroundings there.
I think our fans gave us an edge, quite frankly, because the close proximity of the field to the fans in the Orange Bowl, I think, is documented. Everybody played in there knows that. And I don't think that the fans had been utilized as a weapon in the NFL. I remember sneaking into the Lakefront Stadium in Cleveland when I was about 10 years old to watch Jimmy Brown run the ball. And the fans were there, but they were really just fans. And some would cheer, but it wasn't a unified type thing. When we started the Dolphin, when the Dolphin started to turn around with the addition of Shula in 70, and fan base started to really grow rapidly, and all of a sudden the Orange Bowl was not, you know, every other seat, if you were lucky. It started to turn into a packed house. There was a situation that occurred because when we would go play the game there, we would report to the stadium early, you know, several hours before game time. But we were given parking passes that were all intermittent out through the parking lot. We didn't have any sequestered place, or we didn't have any special bus that we arrived on. And there was, we were just amongst the people, all right? One day you'd park, you'd get a permit to park in parking lot B. The next time it was D or double D, whatever it was. So after the game, pretty soon the fans learned, when Shula got here, we started to win a little bit, and more fans came, they started to learn where we were in the parking lot, who was driving what. And we started having people waiting out there for us to come out after the game. And they started bringing the barbecues out and that's
tailgating.
The whole tailgating thing started right there. And then they started to work together as a chant. When they realized what kind of noise they could make at the closed end of the Orange Bowl, you know, you could literally get down there. This is back when there was no communication between the offensive coordinator and the quarterback on the field. You had to depend on the quarterback's memory. And he's trying to convey that to 11 or 10 other people out there in a situation where he's surrounded on three sides by people that are literally almost to the edge of the field. You couldn't hear yourself think down there, not alone speak to each other, communicate. And that started to be utilized as a weapon. It almost came about accidentally when they started to holler so much.
And stomp.
And then the white hankies.
The white hankies, yeah.
Forget about the white hankies, man. You look up in the stand, look at it, it's snowing.
That all escalated into the fans becoming part of the game, a working factor of the game. And that year when we played, I think it was the 49ers, they were really,
well, yeah,
you know, pretty high-ranked team. And we decimated them between the heat and the fans and the noise and being able to, not able to communicate. We took them apart in the second half.
Yes.
And that's when we walked out of there, and that's when the fans and the Dolphins started a special unity that was mirrored by places, you know.
Right.
Talk about what happens in New York and different places. Pittsburgh, for instance. They started to follow that style. They picked up on it. Having been down to the Orange Bowl and suffered through it, you started to see that kind of thing develop at other stadiums.
Yeah.
And also, we would go out after the game in the parking lot with the fans, drinking beer with the fans.
Right.
After the game. Sometimes till 2 o'clock in the morning, and the Miami police used to come in and park and sit down and have a beer with us too. I mean, they sat there.
Right. Right. Of course. Right. Right.
They would come in and say, "You guys got to get out of here pretty soon." I said, "Sit down, man. Put your feet up." You know?
Oh, man.
You talk about that's why when we went to the undefeated season and we were coming back from those, as it got into the season, you know, past the halfway point, we started having 20 or 30,000 people show up on a regular basis for away game returns. When we were coming back from away game, they'd show up at the airport waving those hankies and be solid inside the airport. Finally,
atmosphere.
They had to move us to a different hangar, move us away from the main airport because it was clogging the main airport.
Man, what an atmosphere.
Yeah, that's how crazy and enthusiastic our fans got.
Man, that's awesome. You talk about, like, and you know, and Shula coming in 70, you know, a lot of people obviously talk about the 72 team, but I've understood that the loss in the Super Bowl in the 71 was really a big moment for all you guys as well as a team. Kind of galvanized you guys a lot, because I know Shula talked about you never want to have this feeling again. What was Shula's message after the loss in the Super Bowl, and that led on to the next two Super Bowls you guys won?
Well, all I can tell you is that everything happened so fast. 69 were doormats. Mm-hmm. I remember one of George Wilson's first talks to us as a team. He was smoking a cigarette, and he says, "Well, if we get a few breaks," and then we all bounce away, we might come out on top, okay? Now we go from that to Shula being in the middle of it, making sure that in the meeting that we had before we got to the stadium, he'd give us the first three plays. So you get the first three plays, so regardless of what's happening on the universe, you better get these first three plays right. So there was a kind of tactic that he had that allowed us to play in a way in which we just simply executed what we were supposed to do after practice, because it was nothing fun about it. If you see pictures of Zonk and Lair, I mean, Jim and I, there's never any of us laughing because it was never anything funny because we were at work. And I think that atmosphere that they created there, that Don created, it was one that the fans, they connected to because they saw that they had come from a losing team to an absolute winning team. So we go from doormats to 1971. We go in the playoffs. In 1972, we lose in the Super Bowl. And then when we came back, he pretended like he was glad to see us. And everything was, well, hey, good to see you guys, you know. And so then we sit down and we start watching film of the Super Bowl. And he started critiquing like we had lost the game the day before.
Wow. He started the season with the Super Bowl film from the previous
year.
Wow.
And then he's reaming us out as if these things happened 24 hours ago, not 6 months ago.
You guys are ready to move forward.
And so now everybody's kind of half stunned. He turns the projector off and he stands up. He says, now, you see how sick you feel now? You see how sick, he's from Ohio, he can't say sorry. He says, sorry. You see how sick and sorry you feel now? Well, just think of how sick and sorry you're going to be if you don't go back and redeem yourselves for what you did last year. And he said, but I forgot to tell you, it was just as much my fault, because you can't be world champions unless you win all three seasons. The regular season, the playoff season, and if you're good enough, your season boils down to one game, and that's the game you got to win. Now, we're going to walk out of here as coaches. You better find a way to get done what you need to get done in order to get back there to win that game. And we were stunned, but we dedicated ourselves to a man that we would take practice and we would employ the game plan in the classroom and then take that and translate that out into practice, because we were brought up from out of the George Wilson League to into the Don Shula League, where in summer camp we would run every play to the right that we had the first team, and then the second team run every play to the left, and then we'd come back and run every play to the left the first team. Then we'd go in and watch it. And then so he'd point out your mistakes there. So it was always about mistake-free football, knowing what you're doing the whole time and taking it serious what you're supposed to do. So we set out not to go unbeaten. We set out each week to take that game plan and replicate that in what we did on Sunday. So it didn't matter who we played. It only mattered how we executed. And when you look back now, you can see that was the fruition of our success, because we did things the way we're supposed to. So we go through the year and we win 16 straight games, and they make us dogs in the Super Bowl. They said, oh, they can't win 17 games. We didn't have to win 17. We only had to win one. And that was the one that we lined up to do. And people can't see that, because their vision of us is the greatness of going unbeaten, whereas ours was the redemption from getting your ass kicked the year before. Now you're back to the one game, so we just happen to go unbeaten to that, back to that spot. So people now think that's the great thing if they pass us. You can't pass us. Well, it's a team that will equal your record. You can't equal that. It's an accomplishment. It cannot be duplicated. You know, how many times can you hit your first home run? Once. And so it's already been hit out of the park, so it doesn't matter how far you hit it this time.
I think the groundwork for the perfect season was laid at what Merck just alluded to, was coming off that loss and that meeting when Shula first stood in front of us and said, remember that feeling that we had. And we reviewed that film and went over it just like it would happen the day before, just exactly like Merck said. But then he stood before us and he said, our objective this year, and I know a lot of people in that room don't remember this, I remember it vividly, because I knew after being through that first 2 years with him what he was capable of as a head coach. And I thought, when he said the next few words, he looked right at us and said, our objective this year is to go one game at a time and win every game. Every game will be the Super Bowl. Now, when he said that, having been what we had been through for 2 years, which I had never seen anything, you know, take Marine boot camp times 10 and spread it out over 2 years. Now you got, I looked at Jim Kick, and Jim Kick goes, oh, this is going to be a beauty. And, you know, I said that later. Bob Green, several people said there was no talk about, you know, a perfect season. No one viewed the season as a whole. What he said was, each game, we're going to practice being perfect on each game, so that when by the time we get to the Super Bowl, his intent of that statement was to show how serious we were on each game in order to get to the Super Bowl.
were we going to win every – he didn't say we were going to win every game. He said we were going to take it like each game was a Super Bowl. We're going to get so instated in that engrossment in what we're doing that by the time we get there, it'll be automatic for us. And you know what? It was. Outside of one mistake, Garrow your premium. Fall on the ball, Garrow.
No.
Another thing, too, you can imagine what he had been through. He had the reputation at the time of not being able to win the big game.
Yeah.
So we could feel the way he was feeling. He had never won. He had lost, especially that devastating loss when he was with the Colts against the New York Jets. And then with us losing to the Cowboys the year before, we could almost feel what he was feeling because they were going to be saying now the Miami Dolphins couldn't win the big game. And we went out and won that game except for what he said about Garrow. It still would have been the only shutout in Super Bowl history.
Yeah, we didn't score a touchdown. We were the only team at that time that never scored a touchdown in the Super Bowl game. We lost 24-3. So all of these factors that were brought in and put in our face, that it made it so that we understood from a practice standpoint what our job was. So at the end, when we're made underdogs, and that meant nothing because we already had our task in mind. Our job was to get back to that game and then win that game. But just as karma would have it, how many times did we win the coin toss that year? I think we won 16 out of 17 times.
From what Nick said, from Bonaconi said, the only time he didn't win it is when I called for it.
That's right. Yep. Put it on you. He called heads every time. And then one day Chicken goes, hey, I want to call it this time. So we're like, we go 16-0 in the coin toss, 16-1 in the coin toss. If Larry doesn't do it, we go 17-0 in the coin toss.
Wow.
If Garrow doesn't shank that ball and then try to throw it and he hits it, we go 17-0. We win 17-0 and we go 17-0. So that's the possible karma that existed at that time. But out of it, the best one is the 17-0.
Yeah, there's no question.
By far, it was the best one. But I think that we talk a lot about the offense. We even talk about Garrow. But the defensive unit.
Oh, yeah.
There's an old saying in the NFL, you know, you can win games with your offense, but you win championships with your defense.
Yeah.
Our defensive unit under Bill Arnsberger was probably not the toughest defense in the history of the NFL. But I will say this, it was the smartest defense in the history of the NFL. We made like 6 major errors in an entire season. There's teams out there today that make 6 major errors
in a half.
Think about that. And think about the IQ. Think about recently I saw Joe Namath a few months ago at the Hall of Fame thing. We were talking, and he said in front of me, he didn't even know I'd walked up behind him, but he was saying, they asked him, what was the toughest defensive unit you ever played against? Or one of the toughest that you know, tell us about those. And he said, hey, the Miami Dolphins defensive unit, he said, was the smartest one. He said, I could never figure them out. Whatever I thought I had them figured out, it turned out I didn't. And you look at the IQ of the players on that team. You know, offenses will win you a game here and there quickly. You know, you get a wide receiver and a quarterback, they're hitting it, or a guy that's got capable speed, can take off and get these touches on, bring it from behind, win it. But to win championships, you got to have a defense. And that defense was so good, so smart, that it made being off. When we could go out and get ball control and grind it down and burn up 4 or 5 or 6 minutes, our defensive unit was so tickled they'd get up and applaud us when we came off the field. Like I said, we won a few games with the offense, but championships were won by the defense, and we had one of the smartest ones that was ever. It might not be the biggest, might be the toughest, I don't know. But I think that defense was the smartest one that was in the 100-year history of the NFL. I got to believe that was the smartest defense it was ever. Man for man, that was the smartest defense was ever on the field.
You know, they said that I saw some piece with Joe Namath talking about Super Bowl VII. And now, this is what he said now. He said, man, I'll tell you right now. He's from Beaver Falls, PA, right? He said, man, I'll tell you right now, man. These guys, the two best the safeties in the league, Jake Scott and Dick Anderson, they get you back there. They show you those phony coverages.
That's awesome.
And make you think there's going to be one thing they had. It's in so much trouble. I didn't know what to do.
That's great.
That's Namath.
That is great. So I have a question for you guys. And, you know, obviously we spent a lot of time talking about the 72 team for all the reasons that we should be. But OJ's asked this question of a few different guys who've been in the tank. And there's talk that perhaps your team the following year, clearly undefeated, you know, never been duplicated, but that 73 team might have been a better team than the 72
team. You know what? Better is not relative. The team itself, what kind of a team was it? Because it's 73. The comparison, one, was because in 72 we had an agenda that was based upon something else. Mm. But we had grown there, and I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, Zong, but Shula then came back and said, the only way you're going to like prove legitimacy from the 72 is to go back and win it again. And I remember that team, we had, I've seen five touchdown passes thrown in games multiple times this year already. That 73 team had five touchdown passes scored against it the whole year. It's now, crazy. You think about that. I remember we played Buffalo up in Buffalo, and we were beating them, and they kept handing the ball off the juice. And Manny and Anderson and Modicani, they were getting pissed because they weren't trying to win the game. They were trying to get juice yards. And now this, think of a team that's complaining to another team, hey, quit trying to get this guy yards and try to beat us. We're out here. We want competition. Don't want you trying to do this.
Wild.
Yeah,
absolutely wild.
I think the reason a lot of people say that is because we dominated more games that year than we did in 1972.
Yeah.
We played a lot of close games in 1972. In 1973, we just dominated teams. I mean, 20 points, 30 points here and there. But both teams are great. It's hard to say one team was greater than the other because right. We did lose two games.
Right.
The second game, we played lost the second game of the season.
Right.
Against the Oakland Raiders out in Berkeley, California.
Yeah, the second game, yeah.
And they beat us 12-6. The offense didn't do anything that day.
No.
And
that's because Al Davis,
Larry's leaning in,
watered down the damn field and had us planting that new sod. He knew how to.
No, we were in Berkeley.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
We were in Oakland.
I know, but I'm talking about that sod was so thick, was so bad.
Well, for linemen, we didn't pay no attention to that.
I did. I got trapped back there a couple times.
But, you know, it was. And they acted like they won the Super Bowl with that game.
Yeah.
Then we went on a winning streak, won 10 straight games after that. And then we lost to Baltimore.
Shoes and, gave Howard that game. That was a
Snellenberg was the head coach at Baltimore at the time. They're getting rid
of did him a solid?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Ropes.
So I have, and we're going to get you guys out of here. You guys have been more than generous with your time. But I have two quick things I wanted to ask you. One, Merck, so I read Always on the Run.
Uh-huh.
I got a copy of the book actually sitting in my car. I didn't know you were going to be here. Uh-huh. In the book, you talk about burying a voodoo doll.
Oh, no. You mean my book, Against the Grain?
Against the Grain. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I apologize. I read both of them. Uh-huh. I apologize for the confusion. But Against the Grain, that you buried a voodoo doll and said the Dolphins will not win a Super Bowl again until it's dug up.
And you know what? They haven't.
We need to go find this damn thing. Where's this voodoo doll?
You know, that occurred when this guy I went to see over on 54th Street, he was
can
one
I write
of those
the address
voodoo
down
guys.
Here.
And he did something where he showed me how he took a bird and put this bird and put these roots over by this guy's place and said, watch, I'm going to make this guy, I'll make him move out of town. So he takes this bird, he puts it over there, and does something happens, and then 2 days later, the guy moved out of town.
Wait a minute.
So I said, wow, this is like it. So I
this guy's
said,
legit.
So now we're at the last game of the year, and I had hurt my knee in 74, and I didn't play. I'd gotten a whole bunch of trouble. I got kicked off the team. I walked out on Shula one day, and then he sent me a telegram now. It says, you're fired the next day. So I had to go back and eat some cheese and go back up with him.
No, he called me, and then, remember?
Yeah, well, yeah, but
he called did. Me.
He called Larry and told him to come back to my house. But that's because I went on Joe Krogan's show the night after he sent me the telegram, and he said it's going to cost you $9,000, a game check. So I went back. I said, well, you know, Don and I have had these problems, and I'm frustrated because I can't contribute. My knee's messed up, and that's really kind of how I felt about it, and I got upset, and I'm sorry I really did that. So then he calls Larry and tells me to come back up to the camp. So I come back up to the camp. We have this little press conference. He said, well, I saw Merck last night.
And since he realized it's wrong, said he was sorry and made his mistake. I go, wait a minute, I didn't say all that. And he says, well, yeah, then that's so I brought him back. Okay, that's it now. So then we go all the way through the end of the season. I can't play. I'm like hurt. He at the end, he says, I want you to run back kickoffs. And I go, kickoffs? I said, I can't go. He says, well, the doctor said you're all right. I said, look at this knee. Does this look all right to you? And so then he just hopped away. So then I told this friend of mine, he said, man, you better go see the root man. So I went over to North 54th Street, and I said, Shula's trying to kill me. And he goes, that's right, I know. I said, what do I got to do? I got it for you. Here, I'm going to give you these roots. And then he gave me this. And this is true, man. True story.
You know,
he gave me the roots.
You know, I had 100 letters from nuns over the years because of the finger on the front of Sports Illustrated. What you're about to say, I'm going to get 100 more letters from those same nuns.
Hey, but the outcome, this is what happened. It's a true story. We go out. And I tell three people on the team that what I've done. So I had to go out and I had to make a Shula doll, and then I had to make the Shula doll and then put him in a box and then bury the box in my backyard. And then I had these roots I had to chew. And then I had to take this paper that he gave me and burn it over the box. And then
he went through this whole process.
I went through the whole process. And then
president.
In my shoe, I had a spider web.
Witch doctor.
A spider web. On a piece of paper in my shoe, and across the spider web was the word written confused. All right? So now I had to wear that and chew the roots as I'm out on the field. So now
Zonk is walking off. He's heard enough.
It's in the. I'm telling you, this is true. I go out, and Shula's going nuts on the sideline. He's already thinking, because Zonk was saying the day before, he's going, hey, the old man's going crazy. He's looking up in the stands. He thinks he sees somebody up there with a camera, and a plane flies over, and he starts saying, mill around, so they don't see what kind of offense there is. And Zonk goes, I think the old man's going nuts. And so the next day.
And you're thinking it's working.
No, not then.
Okay.
Al Davis then is watering down the field, and it was raining. And he's got the sprinklers on, so we can only practice on one half of the field. And Shula was paranoid about the Oakland Raiders because he traded Jimmy Warren. He cut Jimmy Warren the last cut of the year. Jimmy Warren was a starting corner in 1970. And Al Davis picked him up in 1970. And in 1974, Jimmy Warren was still going down on kickoffs for the Oakland Raiders because he went out there and told them every single thing we knew. Now, our record against Oakland during our championship years was 2-3. We lost 3 out of 5 games that we played against them, including 2 playoff games. So when we go out in the field, now I'm not playing, but I got this spider web in my shoe.
The spider web.
With the word confused written across it. So now all this chaos is going on in the field, and they got the Oakland Raiders are out there. They're doing it to us. Ted Hendricks can't be stopped, and so he sends in Nat Moore to help with Ted, with Norm Evans to help block him. So they're on the other hash mark. Ted walks all the way over to the sideline where we are with Shula, and he goes, hey, you freaking kidding me? So he walks just around to the other side and rushes in and gets him. So there's this mayhem going on. And Lloyd Mumphert, when they got on a kickoff, Lloyd slips down, and Jimmy Warren falls on him. So Lloyd's like as a turtle. He's like, can't get up, and he pushes him off, and then he comes to the sideline, and Shula goes, you let Jimmy Warren hold you down? And Lloyd said, man, F you. And so he walked away. And so now Foley's hurt, so he can't play. So he sticks this guy named Henry Stuckey in, who couldn't cover a bridge if it was drawn on a piece of paper with a towel. Hey, he sticks him in, and Branch immediately starts running away with this guy. So Foley goes, what's Lloyd, how come you're not in the game? He said, hey, because Don got mad at me, and I told him to go F himself. And so Foley then goes to Vince Costello,
who was the offensive coordinator at that time. Defensive coordinator at that time, I mean. And so he says,
thank you, Larry.
He loves to be able to do that right there. That's twice in 35 years. So Foley goes to Vince and goes, says, you need to get Lloyd back in this game. And so he goes up to Shula. And he comes to Shula and he says, well, Coach, you want Lloyd back in the game? He says, no, I don't want him there. He says, but he needs me. He says, because that's the way I want it. And so then Costello comes back to Lloyd and Foley and says, well, you got to say, because he's a little confused right now.
Uh-oh.
And that's when I knew right there.
The root man.
Now, keep in mind how we lost that game called the Sea of Hands.
Yeah.
Where our players knocked each other's hands off the ball, which is how this guy caught it against us. Two defensive players we got there. They knock each other's hands off the ball, and we lose the game. Now, at first I told Wayne Moore, and I told Chicken, and I told somebody else, Lloyd. And so Wayne, and now we go in, Shula's crying, my dream is gone. Cooch and Langer crying. We have this done. And Wayne Moore comes up to me, and he said, damn, baby, you should have waited until next week. He said, we could have got us another check. Hey, man. True story.
So,
and it's still back there.
It's still back
and they
there.
Never gained, and I moved. So 25 years ago. So like,
do we know who lives there?
That ended up.
We gotta go knock on somebody's door. Bert.
Back there is. It's too late. He's gone now. Don's gone. But it never happened again. It never happened. And when I got traded, and I told him, I said, you'll do no better wherever you're sending me. And that year, Shula suffered. As I told you, it was 6-8. And that year, Shula had his first losing season, and his record was 6-8.
The root man. I'm not quite as freaked out as Zonk,
right,
because Zonk left the
Chicken's
room.
Neighborhood.
But guys, I just got to say, it has been beyond an honor to have the three of you in here together. It has been spectacular. We greatly appreciate the generosity of your time and just all the wonderful memories you've given us and all the Dolphin fans.
Hey, thank you.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for diving in, fellas. We appreciate it.
You're now diving into the fish tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, yeah. Dolphins, number one. Of course, y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk. Dive up in that fish tank. Go get your aqua orange, yeah, it's time to dive up in that fish tank. It's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank. Rocking with OJ and Seth when we dive up in that fish tank.
Okay, this one for them diehards. Celebrate big or cry hard. Leave it all on the field, we gon' try hard. Old school, a new school, mix it in. Feeling like we up close when we listening. Dolphins tales, in Miami is the deep end. We vibing with our favorite players, no secret. We get with Seth and McDuffie, bringing up stories we never heard to the public. Bet we love it, Dolphins fans never budget. We loyal to the team, whether happy or we upset. We be like, what's next? Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fins. And if you ready for that water, time to dive in. Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fins. And if you down with Dolphins Nation, time to dive in. Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fins. You looking at that fish tank, it's time to dive in. That fish tank. Go get your aqua orange, yeah, it's time to dive up in that fish tank. It's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank. Rockin' with OJ and Seth, time to dive up in that fish tank. Dolphins with attitude, we about to dive up in that fish tank.